Surprisingly, 99% of the genetic makeup of every human being is identical. And yet, look around yourself and you'll see that no one resembles another one. And the whole difference between the millions and billions of people is 1% of difference in the DNA makeup. It's an amazing figure. Another amazing figure is that we were thinking that we are composed of around 100,000 genes, which are the blocks that build the entire DNA, and each gene codes for a certain protein or something that is built in order to keep us alive. But when the Human Genome Project was finished in the late 80s, it turned out that we are only about 22,000 genes, whereas the fly has around 13,000. So we are not so far in number from the flies and certainly other types of animals, and yet look the difference between the fly and the human being. So there's so much that we still have to learn that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created in a way that we really can't even imagine what the meaning of it is. So now, because the DNA, at least that percent that makes a difference between each individual human, is so unique that it is really a fingerprint of each individual. So that I'll divide my talk into three parts. The first one will be using the information of the DNA and some other parts, which I'll touch in a few minutes, to identify human beings for halachic purposes. So today, everyone knows that if there is a rapist or there's a murderer and you find a drop of blood, you can detect the DNA and you can verify whether the person that we think killed was the one or not, based on the DNA identification. If Sanhedrin will be today and will do such a DNA analysis, would we be able to punish the murderer based on the DNA? It's one question. Another issue is identifying parts of the body. For instance, if there is a terrorist attack and there are parts of the body all around, here is a hand and here is a leg, and we want to bury one person entirely with all his parts, how would we know which hand belongs to who? So again, we can take a DNA test of the hand, of the body, and collect the parts that belong to one person and bury them. If someone dies and he is anonymous, there was a war, there was people who were not well identified, especially in the independence war, there were a lot of single people who came straight from the Shoah, were recruited to fight, and the units didn't know each other. I mean, they were just a collection of people, and whoever died, no one knew even his name and who he is, and he was buried as an anonymous, as an almoni. So if there is someone related, we can test the DNA of this buried person and compare it to someone that claims that maybe this is or was his relative, and then identify him and put on a matzeva and say Kaddish for him. We now know who he is. So these are some of the issues that if we accept the DNA as a marker, we can use it for halachic purposes. Another example is for aguna purposes. If a husband disappears and we don't know where he is, until we know for sure that he is dead, or if he hopefully comes back alive, but if he is dead, then the woman can remarry. But until we don't know what happened to him, she is an aguna and she can't remarry. Now we find a body and the woman claims this is her husband. we can detect whether he is her husband by testing the DNA. For instance, taking a part from the dead body that is claimed to be the husband and compare it to the hair that was left on his hairbrush at home. And from this hair we can extract DNA and compare it to the DNA of the body found. And if it's identical, then this is the husband and she can remarry. Another example is identifying a father-son relationship. So for instance, if there's a divorce case and there is a son, and therefore the father is obligated to pay mezoines to the son, but if he claims it's not my son, you had an affair, it's someone else's son, then he's exempt from paying mezoines. How do we know if really this is his son or not? We do a DNA testing. We take DNA from the father, we take DNA from the son. If they are comparable as should be in relatives, then he'll have to pay. If not, he won't have to pay. So these are some of the examples where DNA can be used. I'll come back to each of the examples because there are some differences between them. But what is the basic halachic question here? What is the halachic issue here? So the halachic issue has to do with the concept of a siman, of a sign, right? The DNA is a sign that this one is the one that is claimed to be, or this one belongs to the one that is claimed to be. So he has a sign on him. The siman is a sign that he is what we claim that he is. So regarding signs or simonim, there are several sugyas in Shas that discuss the significance of a sign for halachic purposes. The two most quoted examples are lost objects, aveda. Everyone learned Eilu Metzias, right? And you know that if you find a purse that has a certain tie, that no one ties that way, so it's a sign that only I tie it. And if someone finds this purse and he asks, who lost it? And I say, I lost it. And he says, give me a sign. And I'm telling him how it is tied, because no one else ties it, only I know it, and this is the way it is tied, then it belongs to me. Then the lost object belongs to me. So it's a siman on an aveda, on something that got lost. And the second sugya is on aguna, the thing that we spoke about. So there are whole sugyas in Shas and in Rishonim discussing a situation where a body is found, and on the body there is some sign that was unique to the husband of this wife. And if she says, my husband had a big lump on his nose, and we find a body with a big lump on the nose, we can say this is the husband and she can remarry. So these are simanim. Now the Gemara divides the simanim into three categories. There can be a siman muvhak, a siman beinoni, or a siman garua. A siman muvhak means that it's very unique. A siman beinoni means that it is unique but is found more frequently in many other places. And a siman garua is something that everyone has. Everyone wears glasses, everyone has a nose. That won't be a siman that this is the person that we are looking for. So, in a siman muvhak, according to most poskim, siman muvhak is the oraisa. We accept it like a witness. It is conclusive. Siman beinoni, there's a machloikes if it is the oraisa or not. The interesting point about it is that nowhere in Shas, no in Rambam, no in Shulchan Aruch, no in most Rishonim, we don't find a definition. What makes something a siman muvak? What makes something a siman beinoni? And what is a siman garua? The Ritba explains it, saying that a siman muvak is something which is very rare. A siman beinoni is something that occasionally occurs, and a siman garua that is frequently occurring. But that doesn't help us. what is frequent, what is rare? How do you account for it? What are the numbers that we need in order to specify that this is a siman muvakona? So I think the first that discussed it for practical purposes was the Masas bin Yomin, who was the Talmud of the Remo. So it's really already an Achron. And he discusses the sugya of Aguna, and they found some sign that was not mentioned earlier by the Rishonim. And he says that in order to make a siman to be siman muvak, it has to be less than 1 in 1,000. So if it doesn't occur more frequently than 1 in 1,000, that makes it a siman muvak.
What did he base that on?
He doesn't base it on any source. It's just a concept that makes it rare. That is what the Masas bin Yomin says. And everyone quotes him further, the Bet Shmuel, the Chelkat Machoike, everyone brings this definition, that if you find a sign on a body that you don't find 1 in 1,000, that is a siman muvak, and then the aguna may remarry. And as example, the Maharil says, for instance, the example of a lump on the nose. For him, that was a siman muvak, because how many men have a big lump on their nose? And if you find it, it's probably less than 1 in 1,000. It's clear that no one really looked into it. I mean, it's just a saying, because even the Masas bin Yomin, when he discussed the sign that he related to, he didn't go out and look at 1,000 men whether they have this siman or not. He assumed that it's so rare that we can assume it's 1 in 1,000. So if 1 in 1,000 is a siman muvak, DNA is 1 maybe in 30 million that can recur, and maybe even less. So a DNA testing should be regarded as a siman muvak. It's hard to imagine why it shouldn't be a siman muvak, right? Because it's very, very, very rare that two people will have the same DNA. And hence, if you find the DNA that makes identity, you should call it a siman muvak. And therefore, if it's in an aguna case, you should free the husband, then the wife. If it's a burial issue, you should identify the person as such. And if it's a father to a son, you should say that he is not the father of the son, because it's more than 1 in 1,000 that it didn't match. So that is the seichel of it. And indeed, Abzal Nechemia Goldberg holds that way, and he holds that there is a siman muvak, you don't need any other support to it, and if you verify that it's a reliable laboratory that did it, I mean, there may be mistakes in the process, or maybe this particular lab is not so expert in doing it, so you have to verify the facts, like everything else that you do a test, you want to know that whoever does it correctly. But once you verify that it's correct, or even if you want to be on the safe side, send it to 2 separate labs who don't know each other and get the results from 2 places, then it will make it reliable. Particularly, we have a rule that chazoke uman lo mara umnuse. If someone is an expert, he will not cheat, because if he is caught, he'll lose his parnose. So he wants to be sure. And even more so, there's no interest in a lab, in an anonymous lab, to think that they are cheating in order to get a certain result one way or the other. They are not involved in these cases. They are doing it on a scientific basis. And again, if you do it in 2 labs, it should be considered reliable. It should be something that is acceptable. However, it is still debatable. And not all poskim have agreed to call it a siman muvhak, and some call it a siman beinoni, or even beinoni plus, something between beinoni and muvhak, meaning that if it is something of great importance, you have to have a supportive evidence to this evidence. So just to give you an example, in the Twin Tower catastrophe, there was a married man who was in the building, and then they found a part of his body, I think a shoulder or some part of his body, and they compared the DNA of this part of the body to the hair on the brush in his house, and it was identical. So according to Abzam Nechemia, the wife can remarry. You don't need anything else. According to Rabbi Yashiv, it wasn't enough to rely only on this. He needed raglaim ledover, something to support. And in this particular case, this person called his wife while it was happening, and he said something terrible is happening, and the call got cut off. So that is a raglaim ledover, that he was there, he called from the building, and then when you find the DNA, you can say that it's him. But without it, maybe he went somewhere else, and he was never there, so he was never killed, and the DNA by itself, according to this shita, is not enough of a siman muvak to free the wife.
Is that because they don't agree with the masses? They don't agree with the masses bin Yamin? What's the story
no,
behind
I
the
think,
rejection of it?
Well, so first of all, if they agree, and obviously they agree with the Ma'aril that says that a lump on the nose is a siman muvak, how can you say that DNA is not a siman muvak? I mean, it's very hard to see that. The Rosh, for instance, says that someone who is missing an arm is a siman muvak. There are certainly more than one person that misses an arm, right? And yet, it's enough to make it a siman muvak. So the DNA, in principle, should be a siman muvak. Oh, so I think that's my... I agree with what was said, that it's something new. Who knows if the scientists really say the truth and so... And another thing is that until it becomes really established, if you see a lump on the nose, everyone sees it. You don't need a scientist to tell you that there is a lump on the nose or there is a missing arm. But DNA, the poison can't verify it. He has no way to know if it's true or not true. So at the moment, it's still too new to make out of it a siman muvak, so there, I think that is, I agree, that is why it was by some of the poskim not accepted. But as I said, I discussed it at length with Rabzam Nachem Goldberg, and he said it's very clear to him, it's scientifically proven, it's done not for halachic purposes only, it's science of its own, it's not something that was invented in order to fit a halachic issue. And therefore, it's an objective testing, and it's certainly more than one in a thousand, and therefore, it should be accepted. Now, if we accept it that way, so if we test a father and a son for mezoinus purposes, and we find that they don't match, so that he is really exempt for paying mezoinus, it automatically creates a new situation, mm-hmm. that this son is a mamzer, mm-hmm. right? Because how was he born? If he wasn't born from the husband of the wife, and she was an eshet ish, and there's a child in the world, so it came from another man, and the other man of an eshet ish makes the son a mamzer.
IVF.
Because
IVF, so there's no mamzer.
If it was done by IVF, yeah.
That's what she will say.
She will say.
She
will okay.
say, and that's it. So no
but she can say.
There's medical proof if she had IVF.
Yeah.
It's going to be a history, a record.
But you have to prove that it's not.
Huh?
Calling my mother, you have to prove that it's
yeah, but if it's 100% proof, if you would have two aiding that saw that this woman had an affair with another man, and a child is born, so the chazaka goes away, right? Because we have two edim. What is the difference between two edim and DNA? DNA, for the truth, is even more than edim. Edim can lie. DNA doesn't lie, right? So it's not the same. So one way is that she had it in a way that doesn't create mamzeus. Another way can be that the son is a child of a non-Jew. Then again, there's no mamzeus. And here, no one would know. I mean, IVF, you can go and check if she had IVF. I mean, someone has registered her as an IVF. But if it's a goy, she'll claim it's a goy. So there's a way out. Another way out could be that perhaps for Mamzerus, since it's a Dovor Shebe'ervo, you need two Eidim. It's not because DNA is not reliable, but because without two Eidim, you can't establish Mamzerus. So even though from the truth of the matter, from the scientific point of view, it is a Mamzer, halachically he won't be a Mamzer because there were no two Eidim. That is the same claim on whether you can execute someone as a murderer based on DNA. So some of the poskim say, we believe the DNA that he is a murderer, but halachically, you need to aid him. And you need a asroi, which the DNA definitely didn't do, right? All the DNA says is that he is the one, but he wasn't ever warned before he did it. And then halachically, the Sanhedrin will not rely on DNA, but not because it's not reliable, but because halachically, there are things that are still not.
But Rav Goldberg, who allowed the woman to get married, it's also Dover Shabbat Erevon, it was done. Now, there, Eid Echad is okay.
Right.
That means North.
But Baguna, we are made.
By Eid Echad.
Yeah. Baguna Ikilu. So, the same way as Ikilu by Eid Echad, Ikilu also by DNA. That's like they kill you by a lump on the nose. You don't have eight in, right? So that is aguna is a
kula,
right? Based on the fact that we can identify by DNA a person, there is now just finished an ongoing discussion of many years, has to do with Yaldei Teiman, with the children of the Yemenite Aliyah in the 50s. There was a big aliyah of Yemenite Jews, and many children that were sick and admitted to the hospital, the parents were told the children died, and they are buried somewhere. The parents didn't see them. They came for a minor issue, maybe a pneumonia, maybe even a cold or something. In those days, they couldn't handle the sickness of the little children at home. They brought them to the hospital, and after a day, all of a sudden, all of them died, and they were buried, and no one knows where they are. So the claim of the parents over many years was that they were abducted, and they were given for adoption to couples who came from the Shoah, who couldn't have any more children, and they wanted children. And they were primitive people. They wouldn't know any way what's good or bad. And the children will have a better life if they'll be adopted. There was all kinds of speculations around it. And supposedly hundreds of such children are somewhere adopted, but they were claimed to be dead. And there was a big fight during the years, and there were committees established. They couldn't really come to final conclusions whether they really died or not. It's a very peculiar story, because on the one hand, it's hard to understand that hundreds of children died at the same time. What killed them? So many children. On the other hand, it's hard to understand that no one ever got up and said, yes, there was something wrong here. No physician, no nurse, no social worker, no administrator. I mean, there were many people involved in the care of such children. None of them is disclosing the big secret that they did then. Sounds unusual. How to understand it? Also, there was never a case, I think just recently there was one case, but of the hundreds of children, no one came up and said, I am an adopted child, and let's look in my history, and it was found that he was a son of one of the Yemenite families. So either side is very problematic. So now the Knesset enacted a law to open the graves of those children that died 70 years ago, 60 years ago, and to test the DNA of the bone or the tooth with whatever will be remaining in these graves, and compare it to the relative, the parents most, I think all of them already died. I mean, we're talking about children who died 70 years ago, so the parents already died, but the siblings you can compare, and if you'll find bones of those children and you compare them to their siblings and DNA will identify that they are indeed siblings, then you solve the problem. Then really they died and they were buried. On the other hand, if none will match, so you know that these are children who died for whatever reason, but they are not the children of the Yemenite people of these families, and you have to look where they are, who adopted them, and what happened in those years. That's the Mahalach. That created practical and halachic questions. On the practical level, nowadays, the way we bury, at least in Israel, you know, we bury the body without a coffin, just straight into the earth, but they are the body is surrounded by stones, mm-hmm, and covered with stone, and only on top of it you put the earth. So that if you want to identify the bones, there's an easy access to get to the bones. In the 50s, people were buried straight into the earth. No stones around, no nothing. And what happened with time, that the earth moved with the rain and with winds, things have moved. So if you have a sign of Leah under a certain place, it may be that this Leah is really 5 meters away, and the one that is here is Rivka from the next place. So if you want really to identify, you have to open the whole line of the graves and take all of them and identify them, because maybe you'll look at Leah and she won't be identical to the family, and you'll say, here you see, they just told us a story, but maybe she moved a little. So that's one issue. Second issue is that many of these babies were buried in one grave. They were not buried separately. And the question is, if you open and you find five bones, which bone belongs to who? It might be that one is really not identical to the family, but the next bone is, because this is a different child, and so on. And the third problem is, we don't really know if there'll be any bones left after 70 years, because children's bones are very fragile and not well developed, and they may just disappear and nothing will be found. So the American government, by the way, has now a huge program of identifying American soldiers all over the world from the wars, from Second World War, maybe even First World War, but secondly Second, and then Vietnam and Korea and all those areas that soldiers died were buried without a name because no one had time to look into it. And now the American government is going all over and trying to identify by DNA who the anonymous soldiers are. But these are adults. And the chance that the bone and especially the tooth will be left after so many years is much higher than a child. So that is factual issues, whether it will work or not. Halachically, there is a question whether you're allowed to open a grave because of Chirdat Adin. You're not allowed to open a grave just to look at the bones. And to do the analysis, you have to take the bones to the lab and do the analysis, and then you may return them. So that is a shaila of Nivul HaMes. Are you allowed to take out from the grave the bones, bring it somewhere else, for the purpose of identifying? So there's a shita of the Beis Yosef, based on the Yerushalmi, that there are only isolated cases where you're allowed to open a grave and move the bones. For instance, if someone was buried incidentally wherever he died, but there is an area of family grave, so you're allowed to take him from where he is isolated to the area where the family is buried. Or if you want to bring the bones to Eretz Yisrael, then you're allowed to open the grave in America, in Los Angeles, and bring the remains to Israel. Says the Bais Yosef that only the cases that the Shas enumerated, there is no Nivul Amet and no Cher Dasadim, because the Gemara says that's okay. But we cannot invent other reasons to do the same. That's the Shita of the Bais Yosef. But actually, no one holds this Shita, and there are many tshuvas on other circumstances where they allowed to open the grave and remove bones. So that the concept is it really Nivul Amet, or is it done for a good purpose? So if it's done for a good purpose, it does not necessarily has to be to bring him to Israel or to bring him to Kivrei Avos. It can be for other good reasons. So the halachic shaila is this a good reason just to identify, to solve a mystery? It won't really help much the disease, the deceased. Is it a covet for him that now we know that he really was dead, as the doctor said, and not as his parents said, something of this kind. So there's a tshuva by Avadi Yosef, who says that it was outrageous what they did. He doesn't believe that they really died, and therefore it's important to do the testing in order to verify that they are not the children of the parents, in order to bring to sentence or whatever historic truth to the world, and for him that is good enough a reason. And we claim that the other side is as important as that side, because if it will be found that indeed there are the children, that is also a good deed that the parents will feel finally, or the siblings will feel finally that they know what happened, and you can put a matzeva on them. Now there's no, they don't know where to daven for their child, and no one has any connection with the child because no one knows where he is and who he is. So that is also something that is acceptable, and indeed, the same way as the Americans are doing for their soldiers, the military in Israel is doing for particularly soldiers who died during the Independence War. As we said, they came single and anonymous and no one knew, and there are still, I think, about at least 100 graves that are anonymous, and they are trying to identify them. And the purpose will be that they'll have a name on the matzeva, and a family will come and visit them. That will be for their COVID, and that allows to open and to test. So that will be probably the process, if it will be possible. The interesting thing halachically is that the preferred, and by the way, scientifically it happens to be also the best, where do you look best for the DNA? And it turns out that the best place are teeth. And teeth are preserved more than any other part of the body. Adult teeth, not milk teeth. So if it's an adult person, you have great chance to find teeth. And halachically, according to most poskim, teeth are not mechuya bekvura. That is the explanation on Rabbi Yochanan that lost his 10 children, and out of being sad, he used to carry with him, the Gemara says a little bone, but the Mefarshim say a tooth. Because if it was a bone, why didn't he bury it? How was he allowed not to bury his mechuya bekvura? But if it is a tooth, and if we assume that a tooth is not mechuya bekvura, he could carry it with him. So if we have teeth and we can find them, that will be the easiest halachically to try to identify, and less problematic from the obligation to bury. I'll come to the tools in a minute when I'll discuss some other issue related to identifying using genetics. So up to now, we talked about DNA as an identifying process for many halachic circumstances. In recent years, there is a new field in genetics which it's called population genetics, whereby by looking into minor changes in one part that I'll describe in a minute, you can identify who this person belongs to. Not who he is, but who he belongs to. They did it in Africa, for instance, there are the Zulu and the Tutsi and the, all kinds of tribes, and they are all today mixed together, and they want to know who belongs to this tribe and who belongs to that tribe. So by a certain genetic testing, you can say that whoever has this particular change in him belongs to this group, and whoever has a different change belongs to the other group. And in this way, there has been discovered a Jewish gene, which identifies a Jew as compared to non-Jew. And what is it? So every cell has a nucleus which contains over 99% of the genetic material. And besides it, there are small organelles in every cell that are called mitochondria that have a different set of DNA, a very small amount, only 37 genes compared to the 20,000 or 25,000 in the nucleus. And the task of the mitochondria is to supply the energy for the cell to operate. Now, this is a very stable unit. It's small and stable. And here and there are mutations, which means some changes in the build of the DNA of the mitochondria. And they are transmitted from generation to generation. They don't cause anything visible. We don't feel that they are there. But if you test them, you see that there's something different in my mitochondria than in someone else. Now, the mitochondria is transmitted only through the mother. And why is it so? Because the egg is one of the largest cells, and therefore it has many mitochondria. The sperm is one of the smallest cells in the body, and it has very few mitochondria. And Kadosh Baruch Hu created the world in such a way that when a sperm enters the egg, which means there is conception, there is a mechanism that destroys the mitochondria that came from the sperm. So the few mitochondria that could have been transmitted through the father are destroyed. So it's left only the mitochondria that comes from the mother. And hence, all that we have, male and female, in our mitochondria comes from our mother. And from a Jewish point of view, that is very significant because Jewishness is dependent only on the mother. We don't count, right? So if you go by the mother and you can identify that there's something in the mitochondria different in this group than the other, you can trace it to a mother at some point, and they know how to calculate, that it occurred then, let's say 1,000 years ago, one woman had a change in her mitochondria, and she transmitted it to this day to all the offspring from then on. And it so happens that they tested primarily Ashkenazi Jews, and about 40% of Ashkenazi Jews have a unique change in the mitochondria traced back to a mother around 1,500 years ago. And this change in the mitochondria that we call the Ashkenazi Jewish mitochondria does not occur in non-Jews. So if you take 1,000 Ashkenazi Jews and 1,000 Gentiles around the same area, in 40% of the Ashkenazi Jews you'll find this change, and in 0% you'll find it in the Gentiles. So those 40% have a sign, now we come back to science, have a sign that they are Jewish. Now, what happens to the other 60%? Does it mean that if they don't have it, they are not Jewish? So the answer is absolutely not, because it may happen that one of their foremothers underwent Giyur. Her genes didn't change by the Giyur, right? So she stays with the Goyish gene, but the children are Jewish, halachically. So not finding the Jewish gene doesn't exclude. It can only include. So if you find, you can include. If you don't find, you don't know. So what is the question? The question got to be a significant issue for Russian Jewry. Russian Jewry for 70 years were devoid of any witnesses, documents, anything. They claim they are Jewish, but how do we know they are Jewish? They can't prove it. So the question, the halachic question today is, if we'll test them and we'll find that they have a Jewish gene, can we say based on that that they are Jewish? That is now an ongoing debate amongst the Batedinim, whether to accept it as is, or again, say, yes, it's a sign, but you need raglaim bedover, you need more than that. So I told at one of the meetings a real story that happened not long ago of a Frum family from America that one of the sons decided he doesn't want to do anything with Yiddishkeit. He left everything, he went to Sweden, and Lahachis, he married a Shiksa. One of his sisters felt for him and decided to go and visit him. And she was dressed like a Frum woman with a shaitel, with long sleeves. She looked like we know a Frum woman looks. And she comes to Sweden. The Shiksa opens the door. And she introduced herself, I'm the sister of your husband, and I just came to see how you are. And in talking, this woman says, you know, my grandmother looked very much like you. So he tried to marry a goyite, and in the end, probably, he married a Jewish woman. So obviously, her saying by itself doesn't make her Jewish. That is not something that is reliable enough to make someone Jewish. But someone tested her mitochondria, and it turned out that she has a Jewish gene. So the question now is, would that make her now Jewish, based on the Jewish gene plus her story? So maybe that this story can add to the raglaim ledover that we are looking in order to verify. That's an interesting story by itself. So anyway, if this will be accepted, the Jewish gene, then we can help many of the Russian Jews or other Jews who claim they are Jewish but they can't bring any proof. And again, I think it will take time, it will be a process, and it will at some point probably be accepted, but at the moment it's still debatable. By the way, they calculated the frequency of the Jewish gene, and it turned out to be 1 in 950. So some of the Dayonim said, well, it didn't match the 1 in 1,000. But obviously that doesn't make any sense. No one really meant 1 in 1,000 exactly, because they even didn't look after that. And to add to this, statistics probably is not as important in halacha as it is in science. And Shlomo Zalman brought a very interesting proof that we don't go so much by statistics, because the din is, if there are 6 butchers who sell kosher meat and 4 butchers who sell treif meat, and you find on the street a piece of meat, called the parish meruba parish, everything that is coming away comes from the majority, and since the majority is kosher, it's kosher. Then you find another piece, and another piece. Each piece, you say the same, it comes from the majority. But statistically, it doesn't make sense. Some must have come from the non-kosher as well. Yet, every piece, no matter how long you are playing with it, will each time be rov. So the rov stays by itself. It's not a statistical rov. So based on that, maybe this calculation can be helpful in the issue of the Jewish sheep. There's another halachic question about it, also interesting, in deciding what is the meaning of a sign. We're again talking about a simon. However, in most instances, when we deal with simonim, we talk about something that is external to the object. So if you lost a purse and you find a certain tie, this tie is a sign that this object belongs to me, because only I tie this way. Or if you find a body that has a lump on the nose, it is this person, because this person has had a lump on his nose. The Jewish gene doesn't tell that you are you. It only brings you into a group. It makes you one of a framework. Is this also considered in the realm of a siman, or that is something different and you can't relate to it as a siman?
The one in the 1 in 950, this is not like a rate. There is a certain percentage of Jews among the non-Jews.
Right.
That's what's reflected by
right.
the 1 in 950.
Absolutely.
It's a ratio. Absolutely. That has nothing to do with frequency.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what was found, for instance, I think they tested 20,000 non-Jews, and they found two cases, not 2%, two cases that amongst the 20,000 had a Jewish gene. Most likely, these two are Jewish. They just don't know about it. They think they are not Jewish, but they're Jewish. So it sometimes reflects only the fact that they don't know it, not that it is an error in the numbers. So coming back to the meaning of such a sign, there is a sugya in Baba Batra of Rov VeKarov, where a baby chicken runs away from the shovach, from the nest. So the Gemara says that if you find it within 50 amos from the owner, it belongs to the owner, and if it's beyond 50 amos, it came from the world and it doesn't belong to him. So what siman is that? If they would say, if it's black, it belongs to him because all his baby chickens are black, that's an external sign that makes it belong to him. But to say that if he can go up to 50 amos is a nature. It's not that this particular baby chicken belongs to him. It only says that because it didn't go further than 50 amos, by nature, it belonged to the group that came from his ownership, right? And if it's further than that, it's the nature of the chicken that he wouldn't do it. So we see that the nature is also a sign. So the DNA is part of this concept of being a nature that makes you belong to a certain group. So that is something that is ongoing now, and we'll see with time how it will be finally accepted or not. And obviously the more testings will be done and the more accumulation of cases we'll find, that will be better to establish the chazoke of the new way with this identity. So these are a few examples of using the DNA and the mitochondria as identifying means for halachic purposes. I want to talk very briefly about the second issue, and that is prevention, using genetics to prevent diseases. And there are many aspects to it, but the major one is what's called PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And for those of you who are not familiar, what we do is we let's say a family is known to have a genetic disease. Let's take Tay-Sachs, which is known to everyone, and it's a terrible disease. So in order for a child to be born with Tay-Sachs, both his parents have to be carriers of the gene for Tay-Sachs. They themselves, each of them, are healthy, but their combination creates a chance of 25% that a child will be sick with Tay-Sachs. So that if these two, the man and the woman, would have married each a spouse that is not a carrier, even though they are carriers, none of the children will have Tay-Sachs. But if both are carriers, then a child has 25% to carry the disease. There's another form of transmitting genetic diseases, which is, that's called recessive, and there is a dominant one, whereby it doesn't matter who the spouse is, 50% of the offspring will get the gene if it's a dominant gene. So now let's say a child was born with Tay-Sachs. So we know that the two parents must be carriers, otherwise he wouldn't be born with Tay-Sachs. And we want to avoid the next child to be Tay-Sachs. So up to recently, the only way was to become pregnant, to do amniocentesis, to test the fetus for either he is or is not Tay-Sachs. And if... And abort if we don't want to have the child with the Tay-Sachs, if we find that he's Tay-Sachs. Abortion is a major discussion. We won't go into it. It's not a simple matter. Maybe on Tay-Sachs it's a little bit easier, but there are less severe diseases and people don't want them, yet abortion may be a problem. So that was the only solution. Or that a couple divorces and each finds a different spouse, but that's not a simple matter to do for this issue. So now what we can do is do an IVF procedure. Although the couple is fertile, they don't need it for fertility, but we need the egg and the sperm. We fertilize in the lab the egg with the sperm, husband and wife. We let the fertilized egg divide once or twice. And then we extract one cell from the cells that are now, either four or eight cells, and we test on this single cell whether it contains the gene for Tay-Sachs, let's say. If this cell contains it, each of the other cells contains it, and if we'll implant the fertilized egg into the woman, 100% the child will be born with Tay-Sachs. On the other hand, if this single cell doesn't have the gene for Tay-Sachs, we can assure 100% that the child born will not be Tay-Sachs. So that is called PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And we can do it today on any genetic disease that the gene is known. There are about 5,000 genetic diseases that we know of, and each of them, whether it's rare or not, doesn't matter. It matters for this particular family. In this particular family, if we can identify the gene, we can perform PGD and assure the family that they won't have a child with this particular disease. Is it permissible? Are we allowed to do it? What are the shailas? One is that you have to emit semen in order to get the fertilization in the lab. And here there is no need to do it for procreation purposes. You do it only to avoid a child that is sick. Is it a form of not permissible emitting of semen? And the second one is that if we find a fertilized egg that contains the gene, obviously we'll discard it. No one will want to keep it and carry it, right? Is this a form of abortion pre-implantation? Would it be called that way? So the Catholics say yes. Any fertilized egg is a full human being, and if you discard it, you are a murderer. So they don't allow the whole procedure, because by definition, you'll have to kill some of the fertilized eggs that are sick, otherwise you wouldn't do it, right? So you fight. So when this issue came about, I presented it to Avi Yashiv, and he right away said muta. But he said two conditions. One is that you do it only for serious diseases, and the second one is that you are sure that at least some of the eggs will turn out to be healthy. That was what he said, without explaining why and without giving any sources why he allowed to do it. So my thinking was that the condition that some should be healthy is because if all will be discarded, then lemafrea, there was a tzoser levatolo. Nothing happened with the emission of semen because nothing was returned to the woman and there was no chance to have a child, so there was no reason to do it for Piria Berivia because nothing happened. But that was easy to answer because there's no case that 100% are sick. The maximum can be 50%. So obviously there will always be a healthy fertilized egg and that worry can be put aside. That it should be only for serious illnesses, he really had a foresight, because actually you can do with it whatever you want. You can choose blue eyes for the child, you can choose blonde hair for the girl, you can do all kinds of things that are not even diseases, and that will be Otsazal Vatole for no good reason. There's no reason to have just children with blue eyes. You can also select the gender and decide, I have two boys, now I want a girl, so the next time I'll do PGD and 100% there'll be a girl. Is this permissible to use the PGD procedure for selecting a gender? And there can be many other issues that we may use it or abuse it, and therefore he said it should be for serious illnesses. Now, what is the basis of the heter? So I think, although it can be debatable, there is a famous tshuva by the Chacham Tzvi concerning a goylem. A goylem is, you take clay, you make a form of a human being, you put Shem HaMforash or Sefer Yetzirah, whatever the Kabbalistic people know to do, and all of a sudden it walks, it talks, it cleans your house, it goes to the store to buy you food, and it's very helpful to you, right? But sometimes it becomes crazy, like the story with the Maharal, which probably never happened, but let's assume that it was, and he starts to break everything and to destroy. So one of the shailas that the Chacham Tzvi was asked, can you take out the Shem HaMeforash and actually kill it in order for him not to continue to destroy? In other words, is a goylem a human being? If he is a human being, then you're not allowed to kill him. If he's not a human being, then you're not doing anything wrong. So the Chacham Tzvi paskin that he's not a human being. But what was his source? His source was very interesting. The whole source of a prohibition of abortion is a pasuk in Parshat Noach, Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam, damo yishafech. So the Gemara says, Eizehu adam ba'adam, it's an extra word. You could have said, Shofech dam ha'adam, damo yishafech. Says the Gemara, Zehubar b'meimo. There's only one situation in nature where one human being is within another human being, and that is a fetus within his mother. And says the pasuk, Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam. Not only if you kill a human being, but even if you kill an adam ba'adam, which is a fetus within a human being, damo yishafech. You are a murderer and you will be punished. Right? That's the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Says the Chacham Tzvi, here you have a definition of a human being. Shofech dam ha'adam, who is Adam? If he was Adam ba'adam, if he visited a woman's womb, if he never visited a woman's womb, he is not defined as Adam. And since the goylem never was in a woman's womb, he is not Adam, and therefore there is no issue of shfichut damim on it. So it seems the same here. You have a fertilized egg that is in the lab, was never in the womb of a woman, So he's not a human being by definition. If he's not a human being, there's nothing wrong to destroy it.
Why can't you just say it, since it's pre-40 days, it's Maya Ba'alma?
Okay, so that's, you can say, but not everyone interprets it in the way that you intend to interpret. The Gemara talks about Maya Ba'alma to say that a woman that miscarried before 40 days is not Mayat Leida. That doesn't mean that lechatchila you're allowed to kill it. The Gemara doesn't talk about killing before 40 days. The Gemara just says a fact. If you miscarried before 40 days, since it was miscarried before 40 days, it reached only the level of Maya Ba'alma, so she is not Tumat Lida. But if she can continue the pregnancy, and you interrupt it, even within 40 days, there are many poskim who say that you're not allowed. There are poskim who say that that's the definition of the situation and therefore you're allowed to abort. So according to them, certainly it will be easy to say that usually it's maybe a day or two old, so certainly you know for sure it's within 40 days, so you'll be allowed to discard it. That will be good. But according to the poskim, that the 40 days is not a heter to abort. It is only after the fact, if the woman miscarried, you say it wasn't a human being, then here the potential is still there. You can implant it and it will grow. So therefore, you need maybe more than that. The problem that can arise with this definition of the Chacham Tzvi is what will happen if there will be an artificial incubator. And you'll put a fertilized egg in an artificial incubator. And he will grow the full 9 months and he will be a human being. He will look like a human being, but he never visited a human womb. Would he be considered a human being? So perhaps according to Chacham Tzvi, no, but it would be hard to say. But I think that we'll never get to it. That's my...
I disagree with you. I'm sorry, I disagree with you.
You disagree?
All the literature today proves that within the next 10 years they will have it.
Yeah, so I'll tell you why. I know we disagree, and I'll tell you my position, and you'll say your position. I think that technically it certainly can be done. There's no doubt. But ethically, I don't think anyone will ever allow to do such an experiment. Why? Because even nowadays, when a baby is born 22 weeks of gestation, 23 weeks of gestation, and you continue his livelihood in an incubator, 90% and more are very disabled. What HaKadosh Baruch Hu can do, we as human beings didn't get there yet.
He did the incubator too.
What?
HaKadosh Baruch Hu did the incubator.
Yeah, but if it's a natural incubator, the results are good usually. If it's an artificial incubator, up to now, no one has succeeded to grow a fetus already quite advanced, 22, 23 weeks of gestation, and assure that he will be a healthy fetus. Now imagine to take a fertilized egg and to start from the beginning in an incubator, the chances that such a human being will come out as a human being will be very, very small, although if you do more and more experiments, one day you may get to a point that it will work. But who will allow to create generations of disabled children that will die and suffer? There's no reason to do it. And therefore, the same with cloning. Cloning can be done on human beings. There's no problem at all. Scientifically, we can do it. Yet no one allows to do it in the world. We'll come to other worlds, but let's say the Western world, because if we take the example of Dali, the sheep, this sheep was born after more than 300 experimental sheep that had to be sacrificed because they were severely disabled. So to do it on a human being doesn't make any sense that anyone will allow it. Now you may argue, maybe in China or in Korea, someone who doesn't care about human beings will do it. And then once they'll do it, we'll import it. I don't think that they are interested in doing such things. It doesn't serve anything. It's just a curiosity. And it can be helpful to a very small amount of people, and the investment, the financial investment in order to make it work is huge. So the chances are, in my view, nil. So I'm not saying that it can't be. It can. But I don't think ethically anyone will allow the experiments to do it. So they can keep it for a little while to grow organs maybe, or all kinds of side issues. But to produce a full human being seems to me totally unethical. And therefore, I don't think that it will ever happen. If it will happen, we'll have to rediscuss the Chacham Tzvi and see what we do with it. But at the moment, we can be quiet with this issue. So now, just to finish this issue, we do it in Shaare Tzedek already for many years. Up to now, I think that we had already over 1,000 babies born by PGD with zero mistakes. All were born healthy, with the most terrible diseases that you can imagine. But we are very careful to do it only for serious diseases, and we don't allow for minor things. So I'll tell you an anecdote. How do you define a serious disease? Who defines it? I mean, yeah. It depends. It's very subjective. So we have a committee. I'm part of the committee, and we try to understand what will happen and what is serious, what is not. But I can decide it's not serious, and someone else can decide it's serious. So we had a case of a woman that carries a gene for early balding, early female balding. And she came, and she wanted PGD. She didn't want her daughter to go through what she went through. We thought it's not serious enough. Okay, it's not nice to be balding, but you can have a wig, you can have... There are ways to live with it. It's not cancer, it's not something...
Cosmetic.
Yeah, so she said, you really don't understand what I went through. She started to be bald at the age of 4. And she said, imagine me going to kindergarten. They put on me sort of a wig. It flew in the wind. Everyone was laughing at me. I had a terrible time. And when it came to shiduchim, no one wanted to go out with me. And it's a terrible life, so it's not dangerous, it doesn't kill me, but psychologically it was very difficult. Nevertheless, we said it's still not within the parameters that we understand a serious illness. And the poisek at that time of Shaare Tzedek was Rabbi Neuwirth, the author of Shmirat Shabbat Ki Hilchotah. So I called him up and I said, she's crying, she's upset, she wants it, what do you say? He said, I don't see it serious enough and we can't allow it. The next day, I get an urgent call of Neuwirth is looking for me, please call him right away. I call him, he said, do it, do it. And what happened was, she went to him, she cried, she was upset, and he said, Now I see what it means. It is a serious disease for her. So it doesn't mean that it's good for everyone, but in this particular case, I do understand.
There's another case, Moshe Schlesinger, now Schlesinger told me. The husband didn't have any sperm, and he wanted to have a child. She wanted to have a child. So he said to have IVF, but he wanted to have only a girl,
right.
Not a boy. Because you would have a boy, he was a Kohen.
A Kohen, right.
Okay, not right. To have a Kohen, so he decided...
To have it,
so,
yeah.
And the committee allowed it.
Right, so in Israel, about gender selection, there are two situations where the law in Israel permits to do gender selection. One is if you have 4 or more of the same sex children. If you have 4 boys and you desperately want a girl, they allow, or vice versa, 4 girls, they allow a boy. Provided you can prove a psychological burden for wanting to have the other gender.
Why didn't they use the svara of, you wanted to say that by gender, there's a mitzvah, Beis Himmel says, there's a mitzvah to have a boy and a girl. So why didn't they accept that? If guys had a boy, he wants to have a girl.
Because according to many poskim, you're not mekayim mitzvah spirit of Arabia by IVF. So for the mitzvah purpose,
it's not going to make a difference anyway.
For the mitzvah purpose, it does make a difference. What it makes a difference is for the psychology of the parents. That's what they want. So if it's one or two or three, okay, so wait, maybe by chance you'll get the next gender. But if it's four more, they're allowed. Now, the major reason, that's a secretive reason, the major reason is the Arab world. In the Arab world, if you have, if the couple has four girls, and the mother comes with the fifth child, again a girl, some of them can be murdered. Because it's always the fault of the mother that she didn't bring the boy. And therefore, it is a real danger sometimes, and that's why in Israel it's permissible. So that's something that people don't know.
But do we care?
What do we care that they'll kill? Yeah, they're citizens of Israel.
Yeah, but isn't there an instance when you do the implantation, it doesn't take the IVF?
What?
You do the implantation of the IVF, the new embryo, into the uterus, it doesn't take. It doesn't always work.
Right, but you can try.
You keep trying.
Right.
And who pays for this? Insurance?
In Israel, up to two children. Up to two born children, no matter how many cycles you need.
No, it doesn't matter how many cycles. They pay for it. Wow. Phenomenal.
You could have potentially four embryos, right?
Yeah.
Two girls, two boys. Or okay. Who picks? Does the laboratory just picks? If it's a boy or girl, if you don't allow
Again,
if you don't allow gender selection, right?
Yeah, so you take by chance whatever comes.
So
they don't tell the
lab just picks random.
Yeah, you take a healthy cell embryo.
You take a healthy cell.
There's two in the lab. You choose. Do they know?
But do they know?
Not always do they test what the embryo is.
They don't do.
They don't know.
They do for just the genetic medical test.
Right. They only test for the gene that you want to avoid.
See what the sex is.
They only test for the taste.
Now, by the way, my personal position is that there's nothing wrong in choosing the gender. Because we see in Shas, and later on, there are all kinds of etzes how to have a certain gender. So it means that philosophically, it's not wrong to decide that you want a certain gender. That's not wrong. The problem was that it didn't work then. Now it works. But the fact that it worked doesn't take away.
The poskim today say that not to do that because you are not going to play with God.
Yeah, but
that's what it is.
But according to the Gemara, you do play in a way. You do it this way or that way. It didn't work. Okay.
Well, it could 50% of the answers.
Yeah, 50% chance.
But then you'll end up that chance and having more boys than Jesus.
What?
You'll end up that China having more boys.
Right, right. They have a major problem. They have a major problem. There are other issues that come up with the PGD that sometimes are difficult. For instance, in Yerushalayim, there are very large families. And a family can have, a woman can have 15 children, 16 children. And by the time she wants another child, she's already a little older, right?
Time
works. And then the down comes higher on the statistics. So they come to us, they want to do PGD to avoid a down. But for number 16 or 17, where's the limit? It doesn't make any sense to do all this. So when I asked them, how come you have 14 children, enough? But she said, but when I go to the garden and my neighbor has 18, I feel ashamed. I need to have more. So do we allow it?
Do you?
So far, yes. We don't know what the limit is. Let's say 14 now. How about 10? Yes. How about 8? How about 5? You can't put the limit, but... But I think there should be a limit because really it's...
What age do you... What maternal age? You said a maternal age, i.e. 40, 45,
right.
You do
so the top is 45, because beyond that, not only PGD, even IVF, a couple who wants a child who couldn't have up to now, so the limit is 45, because beyond that, it becomes more dangerous for the mother to carry pregnancy, and there are more complications, and there are more stillbirths, and it becomes more complicated. So these are things of avoidance. Now, a final thing is, we are experiencing now, I think here as well, but in Israel, many single women who try their best to get married, they get to an age, and soon the clock will stop. So we strongly recommend to freeze eggs. From the age of 35 on, to take eggs, to freeze them, so that when they find finally their spouse, and they are now 42, 43, and
what
they don't have...
What if they don't find?
If they don't find, what do you do, so? Either you sell them, you donate them,
but,
or you...
many of them today...
Alone.
Right.
That's
the issue.
And how
right.
No.
So that's
everybody knows that part. I want to finish.
Right. No, so this, you don't need eggs. You do artificial insemination,
right.
And at the right age. I mean, before you get to the age
right.
that you don't have
eggs. Shlomo Zalman says no.
Right. Right. So the reason that there is an opposition is not because halachically there is a problem, because the child will be a legitimate child. I mean, a single woman who has a child, the child is fine. But there is laws, and there is a single motherhood. There are all kinds of social aspects that's not the way we want to lead. But none of the poskim say that it is forbidden. So that
Moshe Rabbeinu Shlomo Zalman says it's forbidden.
Forbidden.
He says no.
Enough for halachic reasons.
What?
Enough for halachic reasons for
right.
social reasons.
Yeah.
And look
say.
What's happening in Kreuzberg, in Netanya. You know, the suing the husband.
Right, no, so there's a difference, and I'll tell you, we are now Shared Tzedek sued. I don't know, Tzvika, if you know, but we are now sued for 300 million shekels.
We,
Shared Tzedek.
Shared Tzedek.
300 million. So what's the story?
Why?
Because both in Lanyado and in Shared Tzedek, the fertility clinic, the IVF, not the PGD, the IVF clinic, allows only to do it for married, halachically couples.
Okay.
And here comes a couple that are not married halachically, they live together, and they say, we want IVF. Medically speaking, they are entitled to it. Who are we to tell that halachically it's not right that you should have a child in this circumstance? Or a single woman comes and says, I want IVF. Or a lesbian couple comes and they say, we want a child and do IVF for us. So both Lanyado and we don't allow it. So they sued Lanyado for discrimination. And we are both, Lanyado and Shaare Tzedek, are not governmental hospitals, but we are public hospitals. And we get funding from the government. So as a public hospital, who are you to discriminate us from doing IVF when medically there is no contraindication? So they sued Lanyado, and Lanyado claimed that they are not worried about the couple being single or not married, they are worried that there will be mamzerus, because there may be a situation that if they weren't checked well enough, like a married couple by a rabbi, who looks into the people, that they are okay and legitimate, maybe one of them is a mamzer, and then their children will be mamzerim, and Shema Yisaach et achoto further on, because it's not registered properly. So we want to avoid mamzerus. And they lost.
And that's a legitimate claim.
It's a claim.
Yeah. Yes. If they're being sued because halacha shouldn't play
no,
a role,
no,
why would
no,
you
no,
do
no.
that?
No, no, no. The man is a goy and a Jewish girl, and they come.
There will be no mamzerus.
No mamzerus.
Right. So therefore, they the claim was. I'll tell you what
the whole claim was. You can't use halacha to deny us.
No.
So
I'll tell you why.
Throw at them, oh, it's a mamzerus problem.
You're right. No, I'll tell you why. Because mamzerus, everyone understands that it is a tragedy. Because this child...
Even the non-religious.
Yeah, he can't marry. He can't marry. It's as if you would say, we will do IVF for you to have a Down syndrome. So everyone understands that if it will lead to a Down syndrome, we won't do it. So that is a blemish. That is a blemish that everyone understands. Yet the court didn't accept it. So they lost. They now appeal to the Supreme Court. I assume they'll lose there too. So now we are in the same position.
Who lost? The
hospital.
Yeah.
Right. So Shaare Tzedek now is in the same position, but legally we're in a little bit of a better situation because there are three women who filed a class action against Shaare Tzedek. So they, as if, represent many of the same situation. And what turned out was, one was a lesbian couple, the other one was a single woman, and the third is an unmarried man and woman that wanted it. So it turned out that two of the three never even approached Shaare Tzedek. They assumed that if they'll come to Shaare Tzedek with their situation, they'll be refused. So that probably will not stand in court.
Right.
The third one did indeed come to Shaare Tzedek and was refused, but that happened 8 years ago. And by law of...
Statute of limitations.
7 years is the border, so she will be out. So legally, we can play with it, but I'm sure if not these three, there will be other three that will be available. I mean, we do it all the time. So what we do in Shaare Tzedek, different than Lanyado, is that occasionally we allow even such that a priori you wouldn't like to do. And Aboshe Weiss, who is now the Poisek, he claims that for humanistic situations, we can be more lenient and we do allow. So he says
Which of the instances? Which?
Let's say a single woman, we tell her we don't do it, go to Hadassah. It's not a big issue. It's 10 minutes drive away from us. Why come to us? So one case was that she said, I was in Hadassah. They behaved to me terribly. I don't want to go back there. So she has no option. So we have to do it. So says Moshe Weiss, in this case, we'll do it. Because, halachically speaking, really, there's no basis for this prohibition. It's more
social.
It's a pasnish, but beyond that, it's not really a halachic issue. And I think that if the judge will be smart enough and will say, even if by bylaws you go according to halacha, show me halachically that you can't do it.
A man who comes to Shaare Tzedek and asks for a vasectomy, and they say we can't do it, makes you a tzuadaka. He can sue the hospital? That means here the Catholic hospitals deny abortion and that's it.
Because they're private hospitals.
What was that?
They're private hospitals.
Okay. If they came to Shaare Tzedek, they'd have to perform the vasectomy because they accept public money.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, that's what should be. They don't do it yet. But it would take abortion.
No
by law,
no man wants it.
Natural.
Oh yes, thank you.
The next class action will be: we don't permit abortion in Shaare Tzedek unless it is a very advanced situation. But the regular ones. But by law, a woman is entitled. If there's a cleft lip or cleft palate, she's entitled to do an abortion. We won't do it.
Asuta will.
What?
Asuta will.
Asuta will.
Yeah.
Yes. Hadassah will. And the law allows to do it. If there is a... Let's say it's before 23 weeks of gestation, it's not viable, and you find a minor...
defect,
and the woman wants an abortion, she's entitled, legally. And we discriminate. We don't let her. So I envision already that will be the next one. And it's not so simple. So that's the story with Lanyado. So Lanyado decided that if they'll lose, they will close the IVF. They won't deal with it, which will be a big inconvenience for a large group of population because they are the only hospital in the whole area. If Shari Tzedek doesn't...
I tried to get my Nei Yeshua to open fertility.
They're afraid.
They said yes. Later on, they said no. It was a time. They don't want to hear about it.
Right. But there, they also have Reb Chaim on their back. Reb Chaim doesn't allow IVF at all.
Zilberstein is his brother-in-law.
His brother-in-law, because Avil Yashiv does allow. And the funny story is that the wife of Reb Chaim was the daughter of Avil Yashiv. And they have an einikel who needed IVF, and he went to ask his grandmother and not his grandfather. Because his grandmother
said yes.
Goes according to Avil Yashiv, and she said okay. If they would have asked him. So anyway.
You gotta know who to ask.
You have to know who to ask.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay.
Shikoya, it was wonderful. Thank you.
I would like